Before the episode begins, we'd like to tell you about Impulse, meeting health pioneers. Impulse is the podcast where you will discover the latest advances in the medical field through conversations with the brightest minds changing how care is delivered. From the rehabilitation of paraplegics having lost the ability to walk, to revolutionary contraception methods for men, the podcast covers current and future wonders of medicine that are or will be transforming healthcare. Your host, Mathieu Chaffard, eagerly awaits you, so don't hesitate and go listen to fascinating episodes about medical advancements. You are listening to Science for Care. I am Anka Petre, and this show unveils the stories behind some of the most important scientific and medical breakthroughs of our time. Dr. AI will see you now. Mycin. This is the name of the very first AI program developed in the medical field at Stanford University in the 1970s. Its goal was to recommend treatments to physicians for certain infectious diseases. Although this program was only live for a couple of years, it opened the door to greater innovations and breakthroughs. Today, AI helps doctors make diagnoses. It aids surgeons in defining the next best step for their patients, and it assists researchers when screening new drugs. But the road to a fully AI-driven healthcare system is still long and tortuous. The Mycin program was dropped because of low acceptability by physicians and poor integration into their daily practice. Sounds familiar? If it does, that's because these challenges still exist today, over 50 years later. In today's episode, you can expect some turbulence, because there is no such thing as disruption without some friction. Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seat, fasten your seatbelts, and prepare for takeoff. Artificial intelligence was created in the 1950s with a very simple goal: having machines perform human tasks by mimicking our brain's activity. One of the pioneers in this field was none other than famous mathematician Alan Turing. He came up with something called the Turing test to assess a machine's ability to act smart. The idea was for a human examiner to evaluate the discussion between a human and a machine without knowing which is which. The conversation was only in text format, and the two parties communicated through a keyboard and a screen. If the examiner could not tell the machine from the human, then the machine had passed the test. This test was presented by Turing in his 1950 paper, which started with a question that would intrigue and stimulate our society for decades to come. Can machines think? Shortly after, two main movements emerged. Those advocating for a strong artificial intelligence capable of human thinking and, why not, of consciousness. This movement fueled a very lucrative sci-fi business in Hollywood with movies such as The Matrix or The Terminator. But not to worry, scientists today consider that reaching this form of AI is impossible. The second category comprises those advocating for a weak artificial intelligence capable of helping humans in their tasks. This second approach has been explored for many years, leading to incredible projects and breakthroughs. To explore some of these initiatives, we have the pleasure of welcoming on the podcast James Samoru, CEO at Somex and fellow podcast host of the Health Tech Podcast and Health Tech Pigeon.
There are a few anecdotes that stick in my mind when I think about some of those conversations that I've had with those people too. And one of them particularly that stuck with me was when I spoke to Indra Joshi, who was the director of AI for NHSX at the time. And it's all well and good having conversations with AI machine learning founders and engineers and even, you know, quantum physicists and all these different people that have these fantastic ideas and fantastic technologies to bring into healthcare. But what Indra talked about a little bit was that ultimately there are a lot of basics that need to be improved. And AI is, as she described, just one part of a very large jigsaw puzzle. And I think that's an important thing to remember, that whilst we can often think about AI and these technologies in isolation, and we can draw a big diagram around what that single AI solution could do, all the, you know, providers it could be in, the people it could touch, the people it could help, all the organizations that could partner with this company, do these things. You can put that company in the center of that universe and draw a fantastic diagram about how it all would all work together. However, often that kind of thinking ignores some of the more basic infrastructure issues, for example, other company issues, interoperability issues, all these different things that make a huge difference. And so I think what Indra really kind of brought home for me was that so much of the complex, technical, cool, interesting, fun AI conversation, unfortunately, does include a lot of the more boring, less exciting infrastructure. And how do we set the conditions up right in order to allow AI to embed, to be adopted, and to flourish? Another anecdote that sticks into my mind was when I spoke to Alina Nadanova, the founder of Phoebris. And Phoebris is a very collaborative company, very collaborative founders, and both Alina and Adam. And Alina said this, actually, I wrote it down. She said, really, it's tremendously important to create a safe space of curiosity, discussion, and sharing of evidence. And that goes beyond publishing a paper every 2 years. We're talking about real evidence that's being generated, and anyone interested in that conversation can pick each other's brain and have a conversation. Now, I think that talks to, you can think of it as maybe sandboxing or lots of different ways this has been described, but this notion that AI needs training data, and you get this data, you train an algorithm, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't need to teach you guys that sort of stuff. But I think there is greater power to AI as a movement where everybody is party to that data, both, as Alina has explained and talked about here, to have conversations, generate papers, but going far beyond that. And this creating a safe space of curiosity and discussion, I think, involves quite literally the sandboxing of that data to allow people with an interest to use that data and create more and more and more solutions from it. I think that as a concept could be done a lot more, could lead to a lot more good. And we are seeing it more and more. I remember speaking to someone from the American, I think the American Cardiology Foundation or Heart Foundation that was championing a lot of this, their chief data scientist. So this is happening more and more. I just think that if you consider the volume of data that we are party to here in the UK, and I've heard a little bit about data sharing agreements, particularly in places like South London with hospitals thinking about doing this or trying to do this. I think where those data sharing agreements can happen and where data can be shared appropriately between organizations, but then interfacing with startups and industry to allow data scientists and technologists and other people to really be using that. And with Alina's point, again, on top of that, that space of curiosity and discussion between everybody to really start to multiply the impact that the volume of data that we have could get us to. One thing I think that is exciting about AI is its ability to genuinely redefine care and redefine care pathways. When I spoke to Alina Nadenova from Phoebris on my podcast, she used the example of pulse oximeters. So pulse oximeters are little electrical boxes that shine a red light down onto your finger and detect oxygenated blood running through your system, and it measures it. So you can get a quick reading on how oxygenated you are, and that should be up in the high 90s. It can get a little bit complicated if you've got like COPD and you're looking for different numbers like respiratory disease and that kind of thing. Anyway, in a hospital environment, obviously there's a clinician that's reading that, a nurse, a doctor, healthcare assistant, that kind of thing. But there's some element of taking into account what that patient has in terms of comorbidities and you know, active disease processes to decide what is a good reading and what is a bad reading. You know, do they have lung disease? Is that active lung disease? Do they have anything else going on? What oxygen level do they need? Are they a smoker? You know, all this really feeds in. So obviously that then requires a level of clinical knowledge. Now, by thinking about where AI can help, if an artificial intelligence algorithm is deciding what is a good reading and what is a bad reading, cleaning up that signal and providing the user, the person putting the pulse oximeter on the patient, a reading, and, you know, feeding into that algorithm might be the patient's history, the patient's disease process, all that type of thing, all of their recent obs and their baselines and all that kind of thing. I guess the question becomes, do you need someone with clinical training to then take that reading? And the answer is no. At least sometimes the answer is no. So you can, and they have trained an algorithm that allows less skilled workers to perform observations and collect pulse oximeter readings from patients. Now, if you think what that can do about the way care is organized, if, to speak crudely, we're making healthcare cheaper because people that don't need that training are not as expensive to hire. And therefore, for places that are lower income, countries that are lower income, all of a sudden you've also increased access. So Phoebris, for example, play in a couple of different markets. They play in the UK, you know, high income country, places like care homes, but they also play in low income countries, improving access, using their algorithms to do these things. So for me, one of the exciting applications of AI is its ability to redefine care, and both in high income countries and low income countries, that can have a huge effect on the efficiency of care and increasing access. Another anecdote to share from my podcast relates to that question that we hear all the time: is AI going to replace us? Is AI going to replace clinicians and replace people and replace jobs and all that kind of thing? Well, I remember speaking to Joseph Mussel, the chief exec of Ibex Medical Analytics. He's also the co-founder. And they have the most widely deployed AI-powered platform in pathology. And it helps with essentially kind of like radiology. So it will look at images and help to define what is cancerous tissue. And regarding that question about AI replacing humans, Joseph, again, I wrote it down in my notebook after speaking to me. Joseph said this. He said, at some point, algorithms and AI will be doing this better than scientists, and the discipline will change. But he also said the role of the clinicians will not to be doing diagnosis themselves, but actually work hand in hand with the data scientists and the engineers to keep on improving the algorithms that are doing that diagnosis. He says that he is confident that within the next 5 years, AI will become an essential tool for practicing pathology that will be considered irresponsible to be doing pathology without. Now, that is pretty powerful stuff, and he is obviously very well connected into this, but it also speaks to the confidence that he has in his platform. He's clearly seeing the impact that it's having. And I think where you've got a technology that's genuinely helping clinicians to the point where, you know, as the founder of that company, you're looking at it and going, well, this is just going to be irresponsible not to use you. You're in a pretty strong spot. And that's not just Joseph. That is a lot of other founders of companies, but also, you know, speaking on Friday on a webinar with Nick Barlow, who is from a healthcare provider who's brought in AI technology and is seeing it work incredibly well. And he also now thinks that, you know, I'm going to speak to him on Friday to see this entirely, but I don't know whether he's going to say it's irresponsible not to use, but he might. And it might. I know for a fact it's been revolutionary for many, many organizations like his. So it's not to say that AI is better than individuals and better than humans at doing anything. What it is to say is that AI is very good at doing things. And the best way I've heard this described is that the way to consider AI is that it's a very, very, very good member of the team. And that's just it. It's never going to replace the individuals, because we're always going to redeploy that individual human capital in other places. But what it is going to do is make our systems better, make our quality of care higher. And that is only going to be a good thing for patients, in my view.
One of the first and most famous experiments regarding artificial intelligence in healthcare is called Sphinx. The program was designed to help doctors identify patients with jaundice, which is a yellow pigmentation of the skin in people suffering from liver conditions. To develop it, computer scientists looked at the reasoning doctors used when facing a patient with jaundice and combined that reasoning with the knowledge available in scientific literature. In other words, they created an artificial assistant capable of supporting doctors in their practice and helping them make the best decision for their patients.
Now, one of the things that's talked about with AI quite a lot is adoption and the challenges of adoption. And I think there are a few key challenges anyway. The first one that I would talk about is, we could call it trust. I think trust between clinical communities and those technology communities is probably, on the whole, relatively low. I think it is getting better, but there's probably a lack of understanding between data scientists, computer scientists, and clinicians. Now, I think as time goes on, those barriers are definitely coming down a lot more. Those communities are interacting a lot more, and even individuals are becoming more au fait with each of those specialties. I think just as a function of time, I think people are just becoming more and more aware and knowledgeable and skilled up on AI and coding and those types of technologies. But also, clinicians are becoming data scientists and computer scientists. Computer scientists and data scientists are becoming clinicians. So even individuals now are starting to be able to do ward rounds as a clinician, not only with the framework of understanding the problems, but actually, having been a data scientist or a computer scientist previously, they also have the framework of how to build solutions. And that is incredibly powerful. Now, we're doing that, those individuals are doing that even within themselves, but those communities are doing that with accelerators and ecosystems and all that type of thing. And it's very, you know, increasingly common and almost essential for clinicians to be on advisory boards of health tech companies or even founding health tech companies and on founding teams. And so the more that we can merge those worlds together, the more that we can increase trust. And I think in order for clinicians and others to adopt this technology, they need to understand it and they need to be connected to it. And they need to be part of its development almost in the early stages so that they have skin in the game and want it to be successful and want to use it. Because, you know, let's not lie, in order to adopt any new system, whether it's AI or not, into healthcare, you've always got to get a little bit less efficient first before you then realize the greater efficiencies of that system. And often that little bit of extra inefficiency is just not what people have time for it's just impossible for people to deal with in systems that are held together by workarounds and goodwill of staff. And so it can be quite insulting, actually, to, you know, propose a new system for a healthcare organisation or department and say, oh, it's going to save you so much time. It's like, well, I haven't got time to learn it. And so anyway, it becomes incredibly important for those worlds to understand and know each other and build relationships with each other, to build that trust and to be able to bring those things. There's a lot of human factors. And so trust is one big barrier to adoption, I believe, at present.
There are a growing number of applications of AI in healthcare. Some companies developed algorithms capable of identifying tumors on X-rays, while others used AI to help doctors interpret ECGs. During COVID, AI was used by hospitals to predict the incoming flow of patients and adapt their activity. The same technology was used by governments to anticipate the number of masks or vaccines that should be ordered, depending on the evolution of the situation.
For those people that are interested, intrigued, enthusiastic about AI, those people that really want AI to be part of their health journeys, I think there's a couple of things on this. The first one is it may already be, and you might not know it. That AI might be alleviating clinicians from administrative tasks. It might already be looking at your cells in a laboratory for IBEX Medical Analytics. So it might already be doing those things. But I also do think that where it's AI solutions that are connected more to individuals and patients and those patients that really want those, I think there is an element of bottom-up demand here. I think in healthcare, I'm not going to say need, but I think there's an element of bottom-up demand being really important. And we've seen that in sort of the smartphone revolution, I think, where all of a sudden there is this expectation that, hey, I can do all this stuff on my phone, but I can't do my health. And I think many people listening to this will remember that time and that frustration that you felt as a patient because you just couldn't do the things that you could do in the rest of your life. You could do your banking, you can manage your to-do list, speak to your family, speak to your friends, arrange that. You can book things, you can go on the internet, you can do everything in life on your phone at that point, but you couldn't do anything to do with your health. And that was incredibly frustrating, and it created this demand, it created this pressure to actually change and do something. So I do think that that may well be coming with AI too. It may be that as AI creeps into the solutions that we use just as a person in the world, and we start to see the benefits of, well, I just do this and this happens, well, it might be that that increased expectation then also falls onto health and creates this bottom-up demand. And so I think that will speed things up in terms of it being part of our daily lives, because that relates, I suppose, mainly to primary care and prevention. And, you know, with that increase of demand, it may be that solutions get funded or ideas get funded that serve that demand, that serve those people wanting that. And that's how the AI prevention tools of the future are developed, for whether that's to do with, I don't know, 24-hour ECGs and anything along those lines. I think you're well within your rights to start that bottom-up demand, because I think without that demand bottom-up,
ultimately, the goal is simple: to improve the quality of care. Today, doctors spend hours in front of their computers researching information or typing medical reports. AI-based solutions are designed to increase the time the medical team spends with patients and to create more human interactions. I know, it may sound counterintuitive. Machines are reinforcing human relationships.
So I think, as I've alluded to in a few of my answers here, I think the conversation about AI has really evolved in recent years. I think it has evolved really positively. I think if you consider the hype curve, right? So the innovation trigger, the peak of inflated expectations, and then the trough of disillusionment, you know, this roller coaster journey, the slope of enlightenment, the plateau of productivity, I do encourage you to look up Gartner's hype cycle to understand basically how AI and everything else, blockchain, Web3, the cycle that all of this stuff goes on. I think AI is really towards the end of that, in all honesty. I think we're somewhere around the slope of enlightenment and the plateau of productivity. I think we're very much over the initial peak where there were inflated expectations and all this scaremongering and doom-mongering about losing jobs and replacing humans and all that sort of stuff. I think that there was then, probably, as I remember it, a few examples of people getting disillusioned of like, oh, it's not going to work. It had all this promise. It's not going to really do anything. But then, you know, people were doing prospective studies and showing that it worked in real life. And I genuinely believe that we're in a much more mature part of the conversation with AI, where we are looking at its actual applications. We are designing technology that does a really specific job with a specific use case. And people are selling into healthcare organizations where it is then having impact. And so I believe we are enlightened, we're being productive. And I have to admit, I have a hunch, and I don't normally make predictions, but I don't tend to get involved in those, like, what are the top technologies for 2023? I don't tend to make those predictions. But I do think that what may happen is in a few years, call it a decade, we might become so productive with the various applications of AI after we do increase trust, after it becomes easier, after probably no code AI and everything else comes in, people are able to design solutions around their actual needs. I think we might talk about a time pre-AI and post-AI in healthcare. I really do think it will have that level of impact. And perhaps even AI just turns into AI healthcare, just becomes healthcare, just as digital health, you know, is just becoming healthcare, right? And health tech, you know, it's all just healthcare now, in the same way that people talk about the banking industry. We don't call it digital banking, you just call it banking. It might be that healthcare just has AI omnipresent within it, and all of the efficiency changes that that brings, I think will feel, certainly for those people that live through it, like a pre-AI and a post-AI period, in my opinion. I really do think it will have that level of impact. So I think it has evolved. We're in a good place. I think now it is a case of building trust, and we're going to do that with impact. We're going to do that with case studies. We're going to do that still with some key individuals and evangelists that push this forwards. But I do think times are really bright for AI technology, and I think it's going to pave the way for a better time in healthcare, where not only patients have higher quality, you know, you look at things like Ibex Medical Analytics and helping diagnose cancers and other pathologies where a human might miss it. So it's acting as a safety net. It's also increasing the quality, therefore. So increasing quality for patients is a big one, but also the workforce. I think, as we talked about, care can be redefined. Pathways and can be redefined and changed. Care can be reorganized. And I like to use the phrase that really in health tech, what I think health tech should be doing is emancipating clinicians to be able to practice at the top of their license. And I think that's really important to bear in mind, that we don't want AI for the sake of AI. We want, as I think Joseph was saying in one of my previous anecdotes, that what we really need is those clinicians redeployed onto what they are good at and working with the technologies to make the technologies even better. So we're going to get a multiplier as to how efficient we are getting. It's going to accelerate because we're then just working on the technology. We're not just working on ourselves. And so I think, yeah, increasing patient care quality is important for AI, but also increasing the quality of conditions for the workforce. And honestly, I think with the workforce crisis that we have now, there's never been a more important time for that to be a focus. I'd like to see business models adapt to encourage it. I'd like to see incentives in the system to incentivize providers to take risks and to bring in AI. I think it should be easier for providers to try new things with AI, obviously safely for patients. And I'd really like to see that from a policy perspective, an increased appetite for risk of providers through policy, but also an increased appetite to look after the workforce as well, and financial incentives for a happy workforce. I think all of that would actually help develop new and the right AI solutions for healthcare. And I'd really look forward to that. But I do think I think the future's bright for AI in healthcare.
For a very long time, doctors were scared that AI would replace them. But nothing is further from the truth. In fact, studies show that the combo of doctors plus AI is much more effective than doctors or AI on their own. They each have their strengths and they make up for each other's weaknesses. So if I were you, I would really look forward to AI-supported healthcare. It kind of feels like the best of both worlds, doesn't it? Science for Care is a podcast by Health Tech for Care, a nonprofit organization designed to support and promote access to care for all. If you enjoy our show, please mention it to your friends, family, and coworkers, and leave ratings and reviews on your favorite listening platform.